better. It was a party which was about the working class taking over. And it was a party which was about proletarian internationalism, though very unfortunately what proletarian internationalism meant was following the twists and turns of the foreign policy of Moscow. In the 1970s, the party was divided into multiple fractions. It existed, it was dominated, the dominant fraction was the Euro-communists, who were advocates of the party reconciling itself with, in particular, the rule of law, with the bourgeois constitution, the party reconciling itself with the bourgeois constitutional order, and building a broad democratic front. The broad democratic front essentially meant, at the end of the day, and still means, these people are still around, though they're no longer organised, that the Labour Party and the Liberal Party should fuse to form something like the American Democratic Party. That should cease to be, therefore, independent political representation of the working class as such. As against the Euro-communists, their journal was, your Communist Journal was Marxism Today, which I think got quite wide circulation. As Hobsbawm is probably familiar to people to some extent, Martin Jakes, and so on and so forth. As against the Euro-communists, there were a whole different range of anti-revisionist fractions, called straight left, called the Anglo-Soviet Friendship Society, called the Stalin Society, called this, that, and the other. One of the anti-revisionist fractions was an organized group called the Leninist, put out a journal called the Leninist. This group was influenced by the ideas of the TKP, the Turkish Communist Party. Now, the Turkish Communist Party was an anti-revisionist party in Turkey, which had a significant mass base in Turkey. At that time, it subsequently was badly hit by the repression in the military coup in the late 1970s. It also had a big base in the English-Turkish community in East London. The TKP had moved from the official communist line towards a line which was essentially on the basis of reading Lenin in the original rather than reading Lenin exclusively through the filter of Stalin's short course and other official Soviet texts, had moved towards essentially the line of the Moscow opposition in the Communist Party, in the Russian Communist Party in the 1920s. That is to say, rejection of socialism in a single country, rejection of the concept of the party as the a monolith of the single and the single person rule within the party, but at the same time rejection of Leon Trotsky's theory of permanent revolution, and characterization of Trotskyism as a form of economism. That is to say, as a form of belief that simply carrying on the industrial struggle of the working class would automatically translate into a political alternative. Okay, now, in 1991, in the late 1980s, the Euro-communists are trying to get control of the Morning Star, which is the daily paper put out by the People's Press Printing Society, which is a front organisation uniting the old, was a front organisation uniting the old Communist Party with the Labour left, and sections of the Labour left and the trade unions. The Euro-communists tried to get control over that by a combination of legal manoeuvres and having the AGM of the People's Press Printing Society, and they failed, and therefore there was a split between the Euro-communists and the large majority of the different anti-revisionist fractions who all walked out. The Leninist fraction said, we deny the right of the Euro-communists to run things, but we also deny the right of the Euro-communists to say we have to go. So the Leninist fraction stuck on within the party. Then in 91, the Eurocommunists liquidated the party and turned it into an organisation called the Democratic Left, which started out as a political party, then it turned into a movement network permitted not directed, like the SA, to doing work in the movements but not intervening in the electoral politics. Yeah. Then it turned into a think tank, and finally there's a few people running a website, which is the relics of the Democratic Left. And the Leninist fraction said, we deny the political right of the Eurocommunists to liquidate the party. They desert, we go on. So this fraction, which is actually a tiny fraction, and it's, we're talking still about a tiny organisation, this fraction held aloft the banner of the tradition of the Communist Party of Great Britain as a party which was really a party which was a fraction of the working class movement as a whole. And what the comrades, I didn't join this organisation until 2002, so I'm telling a history which I wasn't personally part of. What the comrades set out to do was to reforge the Communist Party, initially addressing themselves only to the various anti-revisionist tendencies who had split off from the party between, I think, the first split was Reg Birch's CPGB, ML, Marxist-Leninist, Maoist organisation in the 1960s, through the New Communist Party, which split in 1977, over the New British Road to Socialism, of which it still exists as an organisation of pensioners, but funded by North Korea. through the people who were written around the Morning Star, through the Communist Party of Scotland, which is a separate anti-revisionist split on the basis of that they couldn't stand the other anti-revisionists, and said, look, there is no principled basis for the organisation of separate fractional organisations. It's necessary to reforge the Communist Party. In the course of reacting to the fall of the Soviet Union in 1991, working through that, the Leninist core, which is now called itself the CPGB, and we still call ourselves CPGB Provisional Central Committee. Yeah. Provisional has a certain political resonance in British politics, Irish affairs, but also it represents the fact that we say we are not the party which is needed, we are a ginger group, a campaign for the reforging, the refoundation of the Communist Party. But reforging has two sides to it. The reforging, after, as I said, in the mid-1990s, the mood that the comrades began to reach out not just to the anti-revisionist tendencies coming out of the Communist Party, but also to the Trotskyist groups, who are by and large larger. In terms of British politics, the Labour left has an organisation called the Labour Representation Committee, which has about 200 members. The Socialist Workers' Party claims to have about 5,000 to 6,000 members. Actually, about 1,200 to 1,500 can be said to be really genuinely organised, dues-paying members, because the SWP hands out party cards on demonstrations. So I knew a comrade who picked up, joined the Socialist Workers' Party 9 times on that demonstration. and that, how they count their membership, works like that. But then they take in about 500 real recruits. They have a throughput of about 500 people a year, so there's about 1,500 to 2,000 real SWPers and about 20,000 ex-SWPers over the years that they've been in operation. So SWP is the biggest. Next after them is what used to be called the militant group in the Labour Party, the group around Ted Grant, which split over leaving the Labour Party in the early 1990s, and then split again between the Scots and the English, Scots and Liverpool on one side, the rest of the English, part of the rest of the English on the other side. That has about 900 members. The Morningstar Communist Party has about 800 members, again very heavily pensioners. It's not saying anything wrong about people who are older, yeah? And indeed people who are on pension can be highly active militants, but it is something about the state of the left. And then after that, beyond those three organisations, the Morningstar Communist Party obviously has, it has fewer active members than its 800 formal paper members, because a lot of them are people who hold on to party cards for reasons of tradition and loyalty. But it has more weight in the trade union movement, because the Morningstar, as I said, is a paper which was produced jointly by the party, the Labour left, and a section of the trade union left. So that quite a lot of the active members of the Morningstar's Communist Party are full-time officials of trade unions. Or activists in one or another NGO, employed in one or another NGO, or etc., etc., etc. The Socialist Workers' Party, I think, probably has the biggest presence on the campuses, in the academy. The Socialist Party of England and Wales, which is the TAF group, the grant group, about 800, has the strongest presence in the working class districts outside the Labour Party, on the housing estates, the projects, I think you call them. And then beyond that, umpteen little groups of one sort and another. The International Socialist Group were the Mandelites, the original Grant Group are in inside the Labour Party, Workers' Power was split off the Socialist Workers' Party, Five Braces for Fight Imperialism was once split off the Socialist Workers' Party, and so on. And on and on. I actually counted them, and it is legitimate to say 57 varieties of the British Far Left. So our orientation is project of reforging the Communist Party, and of reforging the Communist Party out of the existing left, and in the first place the existing organised left. There are a whole mass of independents who periodically think that one can organise an organisation by putting all the independents together against what they call the sects. But the problem is the independents in reality think like sects. So that in reality what we've got is sects with one member.
One person split in two.
Yeah. As soon as you get two of them, you get a split. This is not a project of simple arithmetical reassembly. In this one level, it is a project of arithmetical reassembly, in the sense of, if we look back at the history of the movement, the original Socialist Party USA, which got big, quite, so the DEP Socialist Party was a big, serious organisation with big mass base. That was founded by a fusion of three little rack groups. The German SPD, in reality, the Lassallians and the Eisenachers, as of 1875, neither of them had more than 4,000 or 5,000 members. Russian Social Democratic and Labour Party, as of 1903, was a fusion of a dozen different groups. It split immediately, but nonetheless, actually, it didn't split completely. It was the idea of the United Party. In our own time, when Rifondazione Comunista in Italy, which was a splinter of the in some respects like what we are, that is to say a continuity organisation of the old official party, opened its doors to the Trotskyists. it grew rapidly to 100,000 members and a serious parliamentary representation. The Scottish Socialist Party, which died the death in the recent past, again, when the militant group in Scotland opened the door to unification of the diverse parts of the Scottish left, it grew rapidly to about 2,500, which is not a small organisation in terms of Scottish politics. Scotland is not a country with a large population, and obtained electoral representation. So the actual practical unification of warring groups does have, as a matter of practical politics, has a snowball effect in politics. So it's not just a problem project of Ireland. It is a project of arithmetically putting people together, but it's not just a project of arithmetically putting people together. Because in order for that to happen, it's necessary to have a transformation in the way in which people think about what a left political party is. That instead of thinking of it in terms of bureaucratic centralism and the idea of a party monolith, which has its internal discussions which happen inside the party and external interventions all along one line, that you have to have the internal discussions up front, that they're the party of the class, property of the class as a whole, that the internal discussions have to be external and the external discussions have to be drawn into the internal discussions of the party. And that flip side of that, the party has to be founded not on a theory, not on simply a desire to intervene in the class struggle to bring the class struggle together, but on a definite political platform. We stand for this. So we have a draft program. We don't think the draft program is the last word. We say draft program. It's a program which we've put forward for a potential unified party. The problem is that without a programmatic hypothesis of this is where we go next, this is what we stand for, this is what a Communist Party government would do. It is impossible to correct it. It's impossible to go any step forward. You simply wind up following the course of events and leading nowhere. Okay, sorry, thank you. Over.
Okay. So do you think it's programmatic differences that keep the sects apart? Like, I bet if you ask the members of Flight Racism, Flight Imperialism, and the Alliance for Workers' Liberty, which are groups very different, here's what the future should look like, they probably wouldn't disagree on much. But it's their differing historical perspectives that kind of keep them apart and keep them at opposite ends of, one's anti-fascist, one's anti-communist. So do you think that just having a draft program will solve anything, or that it is actually a potential for unity?
I think there is a potential for unity. With the Alliance for Workers' Liberty, I doubt. Simply because the actual project of the Alliance for Workers' Liberty is unambiguously pro-imperialist. And in any case, because Sean McCann has engaged in unity offensives towards 12 organisations, I think, seven organisations in the history of this tendency, and has never succeeded in obtaining continuing in unity with anybody beyond 6 months, long before its present politics. But in relation to the larger left, I don't think there are real programmatic differences between, in fact, even between the Communist Party, the Morning Star people, Socialist Workers' Party, and Socialist Party of England and Wales. What keeps them apart at the end of the day is the rivalry of for control of the central leaderships and of the apparatus. The SWP has a pretty quite elaborate top-down apparatus of full-timers in each locality, all appointed by the centre.
In the talk you gave at the University of Chicago on Thursday, you distinguished the approach of the CPGB as that of directing or focusing their critical efforts by addressing the rest of the left, rather than, as you would put it, as a narrow sectarian approach, is simply assuming that, that the proper role of any communist organization is to immediately approach the masses, with their kind of program or ideological idiosyncrasies in mind. And from what you said today, it's clear that you addressing left to be basically on a programmatic basis of trying to reforge by achieving programmatic unity. And if not unity, then at least raise what are now kind of tacit disagreements to conscious, deliberative political struggles and fights. Is that a correct characterization?
Yeah, pretty much. I wouldn't say that we, how shall I put it? We engage with the left in terms of the character of the Weekly Worker. The character of the Weekly Worker is the paper, which we put out, is modelled in absolute outline on Iskra, in the sense that our view is that in order to have unity, the differences have to be open and upfront. The condition of effective practical unity on the, let's say, 90% to which the far left all agrees with each other, we can all do. But actually, in order to have unity, we have to have the differences open and upfront. Now, then the consequence is the paper is a fighter for unity, but a fighter for unity on the basis of bringing the differences open and upfront. So that one side of it is we try to report what the political differences within the Socialist Workers' Party are, which they think is a violation of their right to privacy. On the other side, we actually do engage in polemics. Now, we engage in polemics about theoretical questions, but that's not the same thing as thinking that the unity has to be based on agreement on theory, because in reality it never will be. Take the fusion of the Bolsheviks and the Bezhoryansky in July 1917, there is absolutely no reason to suppose that, as the Trotskyists claim, that Lenin went over to Trotsky's theory of permanent revolution is inconsistent with the stuff that Lenin actually wrote after April 1917. So the reality was that in July 1917, the Bolsheviks and the Bezhoryansky were able to fuse because they said came to common programmatic conclusions on the basis of different theoretical approaches.
But what do you see to be the relationship between program, on the one hand, and Marxism, on the other? Because it seems as though that you've identified a certain crisis on the left as basically a programmatic crisis of basically unconscious differences being the cause of rife sectarianism and inefficiency. But I mean, how do you understand the crisis of Marxism as a way of like thinking of capitalism and the possibility of a world beyond capital bearing on the problem of practical regroupment and the forging of a new communist party?
My understanding in terms of Marxism as a political project, what is Marxism's political project? Marxism's political project is quite simply the idea that the working class should take over, and that the only mode, it's expressed most clearly and most briefly in the program of the French Parti Ouvrier, that the emancipation of the working class can only take place through the working class laying collective hands on the means of production. It's impossible now to go back to individual family-based production, and that therefore the working class as a class needs to lay collective hands on the means of production. And that in order to begin to approach the question of the working class laying collective hands on the means of production, the class as a class needs to be organised in a distinct political party, as a class party. Now, then the second side of this, we have, consistently in all the programmes which Marx and Engels had a hand in, demands for radical democracy. Democracy without the single person, without the presidency, without judicial review, without the rights of the church to hold on to land in the form of Bombay, for universal military service and people's militia, for the uncontrolled freedom of local government. These are consistent elements of the programs put forward by Marx and Engels. And that the theory which lies behind it is inconsistent. You ask the question, what is Marxism? Actually, in relation to the development of political economy, in relation to the development of historical materialism, we have a vast mass of stuff which Marx didn't think was publishable, which is used by subsequent Marxists to construct Marxist theories. Bob.
I'll go.
This is a question about the political nature of splits and improvements. In the course of the second of the crisis that World War I provokes, the Second International parties in Germany and Russia go through a series of splits, which are seen as indicate as being reflections of the crisis outside society. And in particular, it's the one party, one class line of Kautsky is ultimately is tied to the decision to vote for the war crimes in Germany. The reason I bring up this history is that I think that the question of unity is that in some sense a recognition that the moment we have now does not permit for splits or regroupments precisely because there is no crisis that would enable us to have revolution at which point splits and regroupments could become productive.
Sects are not a novelty. You know, the Socialist Labour Party in the United States before the First World War, the Heinemann organisation in Britain before the First World War. What we have is, through the choices which were made by the Bolsheviks in 1918 to 21 in order to construct the worker state as a man on horseback, which represented represented the peasantry by mastering it. Yeah. We have constructed a dogma of that the revolutionary party has to be something like the Heinemann organization or something like similarly another sect, Rosa Luxemburg's SDKPIL in Poland. Yeah. We have to overcome that. The class party is not Kautsky's original idea. It's Marx and Engels' original idea taken from the taken from Chartism, you know, in its origins. Okay, that's the nonetheless there has to be a split from the Second International. And that is, it is genuinely right that there has to be a split from Second International, but why there has to be a split from Second International is simply because the capitalist class, through the state and through the press, intervenes in the internal affairs of the socialist parties in order to exclude the left from speaking. We have that in terms of the British Labour Party. We are for the British Labour Party abandoning the bans and prescriptions on communist organisations which it adopted in 1919 and turning itself into a general united front of the working class parties and organisations.
What about militant tendency?
So?
What about militant tendency?
So, do we include, for example, yeah? So the exclusion of militant tendency we would regard as being an expression of the capitalist class exercising control of workers' representation.
Mm-hmm. What's there and there?
Yeah, but isn't that exactly wrong? Isn't the problem a matter of program? I mean, Lenin understood the significance of World War I to be that it was a wing of the socialist movement that programmatically was tied to the capitalist class, not necessarily organizationally or through the press or what have you. And it seems to me that the strategy of the CPGB is to reconstruct some sort of Second International type Kautsky as a party of the whole class. Just to be fair, to let you know exactly where I'm coming from, I'm with International Bolshevik Tendency.
Yeah, yeah, okay. I think the problem with this line of argument is Zinoviev and Kamenev. Yeah? Zinoviev and Kamenev, as is well known, opposed the October Revolution in the bourgeois press. So what that tells us, and actually we can see it also in the subsequent history of the communist parties, that is the organisational separation from the part of the workers' movement which is committed to support the bourgeoisie, does not produce political purity. the making the split does not in fact reduce political purity. If anything, on the contrary, similarly, at the time of the after the February Revolution, Lenin comes back and finds Stalin, Kamenev leadership of the Bolshevik Party engaged in negotiations to refuse with the Mensheviks on the Mensheviks' program, and he's able to defeat that because of the open character of internal debate in the Bolshevik Party. He relies on the Vyborg district and the papers of the Vyborg district, the public press of the Vyborg district, to overturn the line of the Central Committee. So the idea that organisational separation from the right wing preserves you from the influence of the bourgeoisie is illusory. The influence of the bourgeoisie exists, operates within the party, however much it organisationally separates from the right wing. What one needs to be doing is engaged with the right wing in political struggle as an open public faction. But of course they won't let us, long as they have the backing of the bourgeoisie to use the state to exclude us from, to exclude organised factions like the militant tendency from the Socialist Party, then it inevitably follows that you have to organise independently. It's not that organising independently in itself is a great thing. You know? It's that it's something which is forced on us by the intervention of the bourgeoisie and the workers. And that goes back again. Bismarck expelled Wilhelm Liebknecht from Prussia in order to affect the internal affairs of the ADAV, General German Workers' Association, founded by Lassalle.
I think program is extremely important. And one of the things I see here is in the Platypus meeting as a whole is trying to come to grips with understanding the history and what Marxism is and what failings have happened and so forth. But I think program is not as important as it is, it's not the most fundamental that we're facing. If you look at the recent United States history of working class militancy or the left, a lot of it came out of the civil rights movement in the United States, 40s, 50s, 60s, which was essentially a working class movement. And this is what brought the radicalization to the United States, including the ability to build an anti-war movement, a feminist movement, gay rights, whatever else like that. And so it wasn't program that gave rise to this radicalization. It was real social movements. And I think when we look at Russia, we have 1905, we have 1917, especially February, that enabled people like Lenin to, number one, further develop the program. Was it Lenin? And all the time it was a development. And you know, we have April,
I'm sorry, I have to hit for a question just to be able to have questions.
So the question is, how are we trying to relate to real struggles that are beginning to unfold in the United States, and I'm sure in Britain also, to intervene, to guide them, and to learn from them?
Two sides of a coin. The reason why you have to have definite political program is precisely in order to avoid, among other things, splitting over tactical differences, unnecessary, unprincipled splits over tactical differences, and in order to allow the membership to actually hold the leadership to account. Because if you don't have a definite political program, you just have, what it collapses into is the idea of Lenin's nose, which Tony Cliff was the great argument for. And that's equally true if you say back the mass movement. Because, yeah, there are mass movements, but there are also mass movements, like the Ulster Workers' Council strike in the 1970s, which was a mass movement of the Ulster working class to demand the suppression of the Catholics. Yeah? Of the loyalist working class to demand the suppression of the Catholics. You nonetheless nonetheless, you always have to, there are always political choices here. Okay, very concrete, cuts. Yeah. We have a struggle going on against cuts, which is a mass movement. The problem is finding political expression to that mass movement. And the obstacle to finding political expression to that mass movement is that we have a national right to work campaign which is organised by and controlled by the Socialist Workers' Party. National Shop Stewards Against Cuts campaign, which is organised and controlled by the Socialist Party of England and Wales. The People's Charter, which is organised and controlled by the Communist Party of Britain, Morning Star. And an organisation called National Cuts Coordinating Committee, which is organised and controlled by a small group which is splintered off the Socialist Workers' Party, but which has better relations with trade union leadership and therefore has more forces and so on and so forth. So the problem is, actually it turns out that this question of division of the left affects the ability to run the mass movement. And in reality, if we go back to the civil rights movement, the civil rights movement could happen on the scale and in the way in which it happened and so on and so forth, because it was still the case that the Communist Party USA, although hit hard by McCarthyism, was absolutely dominant on the American left, was on a scale dramatically beyond any of the other organisations of the left. You can't have it just on the basis of a bunch of... But if you have a bunch of sects which are all competing with each other, the effect is not just that there's no party, it also functions as a practical obstacle to the progress of the mass movement. That doesn't apply in the case of trade unions, of course, because in the case of trade unions, well, it does in France. In France, the division of the parties is reflected in the division of the trade unions, and the division of the trade unions reduces the effectiveness of the trade unions. But in Britain and the United States, it's unitary trade union movements. Trade unions live and function without, irrespective of the fact that there's a whole load of bloody sects functioning within them. But beyond trade union struggles, organising the mass movement, the existence of the sects is a practical obstacle.
Yeah, I don't understand why what you're advocating, which I'll call neo-Kautskyanism, you don't seem to object to, why you think that that is less utopian than some kind of what you would call sectarianism, like the guy from the Bolshevik tendency. I mean, at least in the United States, the prospect of a mass Kautskyan party of the whole class is at least as utopian as building a little political sect. I mean, certainly in the present. So why would, say, American socialists then orient themselves towards what would seem just as impossible a project, rather than focusing on at least the intellectual clarity afforded by sectarianism, theoretically, although the fact is that a lot of the sects don't actually differ in terms of ideas, but just yes. On principle.
I think the sects don't, actually. I think the sects produce the opposite of intellectual clarity. And if one, again, on the basis of the British experience, the Socialist Workers' Party, the Socialist Party of England and Wales, and indeed the Communist Party of Britain, are theoretically barren. The Socialist Workers' Party has an offshoot, the International Socialism Journal, which it reads in the academy.
Right, but... Yeah. But
so
aren't you...
I don't think you actually... I think it's an illusion to suppose that the production of the sect produces theoretical clarity.
Okay, but...
The sects... Okay.
Let me just...
The idea of... Let's call it... We call it for the sake of argument.
Like, I think Richard may
want to... I just want to describe an experience. For a while, there was this attempt in the United States to create a Labour Party. And the whole Labour Party movement was basically a fraud, because it was supposedly an attempt to build a broad Labour Party. But everybody in this Labour Party was a member of some sect, basically. There were hardly any non-sectarians who were all trying to pretend that they were sort of part of this broad non-sectarian movement that was just one sectarian maneuvering against another sectarian. I mean, however you understand that as the self-deception of these sectarians, it raises the question of whether the Labour Party itself then just became a kind of different type of sect. I mean, I don't see the basis in the present for a belief that if one suddenly somehow dropped a quote sectarianism, one could build a mass Kautskyan party. I mean, we wouldn't be building a mass Kautskyan party, certainly not in the United States. Maybe in Britain things are different, but there you would have the Labour Party. I mean, you presumably have to split the Labour Party.
Okay.
Or take it over. Yeah. I'm not sure which you see as the prospect.
The difference essentially is there is an objective basis that the working class as a class has an objective interest in independent political representation. Yeah. Now, you're right in relation to the sects pretend to be social democrats, and the sects pretend to be social democrats and set up a fake Labour Party. We've actually seen, because loads of sects in Britain say the Labour Party has ceased to be a Labour Party in any sense whatever, not even a bourgeois workers' party, it's become a purely bourgeois party, therefore we need to set up a new Labour Party. And then they set up organisations which pretend to be a new Labour Party, and yet, in reality, are just the sects. What we say is it's necessary to set up a communist party, and that setting up a communist party involves breaking from bureaucratic centralism. And if you break from bureaucratic centralism, the possibility exists, therefore, it may also involve self-denying ordinance, Oliver Cromwell, self-denying ordinance, all the people who are currently generals have to step down. In setting up a communist party, what we're doing is we're abandoning those parts of our tradition, and it's my tradition as well as other people's. So I was a Trotskyist for donkey's years. Yeah. We're abandoning those parts of our tradition which are plainly and obviously wrong, whilst putting up front those parts of our tradition which we think continue to be right, that the working class should take over, that the working class is an international class, a matter of international class solidarity, that we reject the idea of loyalty to the existing state apparatus. And that's where I differ from Kautsky. Kautsky, quite plainly, okay, he's not loyal to the German imperial right, but he's loyal to the idea of the bourgeois state for bourgeois constitutions.
Yeah, just to get back to the young man's question before, it seems to me that this argument relies, I mean, that raising the question of the German experience and the spontaneous development of revisionism within Marxism, right, that Marxism's own success generates revisionism, and that was clearly indicated in the history of Germany, that your argument would seem to necessitate that revisionist tendencies within Marxism are going to take the form of factional struggle in the course of their development and conflict with what we might call revolutionary or anti-revisionist tendencies. But the history of the German party doesn't reveal that. The point is that the revisionists didn't bother to have it out at the level of theory. They didn't bother to form factions, right? They said, no, we're not going to vote for war credits, we're dedicated to the program, etc. We've passed these resolutions. They said it right down weeks until the beginning of World War I.
That's just false, regrettably. The history of the... If you read... it's the histories of the German Social Democratic Party in general tend to be written from either a Cold War narrative or from a Leninist narrative. But if you actually read the biographies of Liebknecht, Babel, Kautsky, the history of the German social democracy is actually characterized by persistent factional struggles, largely driven by the effort of the revisionists and the right wing from going back to the struggle over Düring to stop publication in the party press of anti-revisionist articles.
indeed, one can't speak of revisionism because it starts out as a struggle between Marxists and LaSallians, in which at that time Bernstein is one of the leading representatives of the Marxists. Vollmar, who becomes one of the...
The point is, to say that stifling the publication of anti-revisionist articles is a form of factionalism, right, it's instead saying that the one-party, one-class form is a depoliticizing form.
No, I don't think so. Because everybody understood at the time that there are factions in this party. They're not as strongly organized. I think that what's novel about Bolshevism happens by accident. And it happens by accident because they happen to have a majority in 1903. And then they go on forever after saying, well, we're the majority, and therefore we're not going to do what the... we won't be bound by the views of the minority. Yeah. But the result is that we get organized, open, organized factions with their own press. But actually that's true. Denied Scientists is a paper of the left. What happens is Kautsky capitulates. Centre capitulates. Babel dies. We don't know what Babel would have done in 1914. Kautsky capitulates to the right. Yeah. But that's, at one level, that's, Zinoviev, Kamenev, Piatnikov, Radek, etc., capitulated to Stalin. The existence of people who capitulate is just, that's how it is. Chomak Kamner has capitulated to Eustonism.
I guess I just piggyback off those two questions, Watson's and Spencer's, about the history of the Second International and the kind of political meaning of a theoretical split. Like how it seems to me that the history of the Second International sheds light on theoretical differences that then become political differences, and what that means. Of when do theoretical differences in articulating the goals of a party come to affect the politics and the political orientation of the party? And it seems to me something that we've sort of asked ourselves, at least in New York, when we read the Second International Radicals, is, are we saying that we would have wanted a split to happen? Like, when does the situation sort of change to the point in which a political split of the party is, like, necessary? Are splits sort of historically and politically meaningful? At least the sort of raising of the problem in retrospect, seeing as though the history of the Second International led to a particular disaster. I mean, I guess one way we could understand it is capitulation, right? Like we could say, like, okay, well, people capitulated, sort of betrayed the left, within the party. Or one could raise it to the level of, like, well, what does it mean that there is this revisionist debate? What does it mean that there are these theoretical differences that, in a sense, actually don't come to be articulated politically? I mean, one way in which we talked about it was that it seemed as if members of the party saw their membership to the party as being the common base, the denominator of their relationship to their comrades within the party, but that then those theoretical differences were never to raise the level of, like, political difference. Well, how does the trajectory of the Second International shed light on the political meaning of actually those theoretical differences?
Yeah, I would put it probably the other way, in the sense that it seems to me that the people who raised... The people who raised theoretical difference in the sense of arguing for what Sorel called the decomposition of Marxism, which Luxembourg echoes. The left critique of Kautsky, most of those people, the left critique of the center, most prominent person who was the backer of that left critique of the centre is Benito Mussolini. Or Robert Michels, who wrote from that perspective on the Social Democratic Party of Germany, became a Nazi in the 1920s and 30s. And his book is used as a textbook in American political science departments to prove the impossibility of democracy. Yeah. The bureaucracy, that elites are inevitable element of society. Luxembourg made the split. She forced the split with the right wing in Poland. And what was created was an impotent sect. And the Communist Party of Poland did not originate out of Luxembourg's SDKPIL, but out of the PPS Lewica, which was a left split in the nationalist PPS.
So to make the split, to fight the, if anything, I think the issue, we misread the history of the social democracy before 1914, because we imagined that there were big theoretical debates which were fully thought out as theoretical debates, but no political debates. In reality, there's constant political debates, which we don't understand because we don't read, because people, not enough people read German, because not enough being translated, about who you vote for in elections, about whether to participate in government, about whether to vote for the a coalition budget in a local authority, in a land and a provincial authority. And those constant political debates are very imperfectly theorized. And partly they're very imperfectly theorized because Bernstein, Vollmar is anti-theoretical. Bernstein is actually a Fabian. He constantly says, I'm not a Fabian. But if you read Bernstein and set it against the English Fabians, it's quite clear that Bernstein is simply reproducing the theoretical conceptions of the Webbs, and G.B. Shaw, and Wells, and so on.
But what
so, hold on, Richard. We're actually at the end of the time. Maybe we could merge these two. You guys could just ask your questions, so get one response.
Well, I guess I have a short question. If the Labour Party is not trying to intersect, or if it's impossible because of the politics of the Labour Party to try to take them over or split them, well, how do you relate to the SWP? It seems like you're saying that the SWP is also similar. But I mean, it's like way smaller, but it's not even possible to take over the SWP. Like, why doesn't
we don't say that?
Hold on.
Sorry, this is just for time and then this.
Yeah, as a precondition for the successful Russian Revolution of 1917 was the split of 1903, which was only imperfectly realized. And Lenin had to work his way towards an understanding that reconciliation with the Mensheviks was an impossibility if the revolution was to be a real possibility. He had to choose between unity with those that represented the interests of the bourgeoisie within the workers' movement, i.e. the Mensheviks, and separation from them. And the more perfect the separation became, the more revolutionary the institute, the capacity of the Bolshevik Party developed. And the idea that the return to Kautskyism is somehow going to move the working class closer to power is at the core of what's wrong with the CPGB. And
What's the question? We're just very short on time.
My question is, do you regard the split in 1903 as a mistake?
Okay, it's two steps. One, Labour Party. We don't in the least think it's impossible to. We put forward theses actually earlier this year or just last year on the question of the Labour Party. Yeah. Our view is that it's theoretically possible. That communists could, by winning the majority in the British trade unions, overthrow the constitution of the Labour Party and transform the Labour Party into a general workers' united front, an electoral united front. Yeah. And we, in fact, intervene. We are not for general entry in the Labour Party, which requires the communists to pretend, in order to maintain Labour Party legality, to pretend to be Labourites. But we are for fraction, and we actually do fraction work in the Labour Party. We don't do fraction work in the Socialist Workers' Party, though it is the case if people come to CPGB conclusions in the Socialist Workers' Party, we ask for them to fight where they are in the Socialist Workers' Party, not to walk out. In reality, what practically happens is that as soon as, it doesn't have to be CPGB conclusions, anybody who raises trivial dissent in the Socialist Workers' Party, unless it's John Molyneux, who's the licensed oppositionist, is expelled of factionalizing or having attempting to discuss outside of pre-conference meeting. So we don't in the least say either that the Socialist Workers' Party can't be won from Marxism or that the Labour Party can't be won from Marxism. We say that it's necessary to organize independently of. That doesn't mean separately, not dependently on, to have our own press, not to just operate as a loosely connected group of people who freelance on the Labour left. In relation to split in 1903, it's just false history. Literally, straightforwardly false history. First off, the Mensheviks walked out. That's what happened. What happened in 1903 was that the Mensheviks walked out. Afterwards, in 1907, Lenin was in a block with Plekhanov against the Otsovists and the Period. The split in Russia hardly took place at all outside Petrograd and Moscow. In 1917, the Bolsheviks and the Mensheviks remained in Siberia in a common organization until after the seizure of power in October. And that maintenance of common organization was deliberately authorized by the Central Committee of the Russian Party, and it was authorized by the Central Committee of the Bolsheviks, by the Bolshevik Central Committee, and it was authorized by the Bolshevik Central Committee precisely because, in reality, the Russian Revolution couldn't have succeeded without it, because the control which that unified organization was through the Siberian Soviets were able to exert provided the food which meant that Moscow and Leningrad didn't starve in November 1917. So it was a military necessity. And this narrative of the split in 1903 is just a false narrative. It's the same thing as same sort of false narrative, actually, as the counter-revolutionary bloc rights of Trotskyites. And it's the same sort of narrative as the bloc rights of Trotskyites, because it comes from the same bloody source. It is part of the Stalin school of falsification.
On that note,